Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We'll begin today, as we usually do on Fridays, with our weekly Ask the Mayor segment, My Questions and Yours, for Mayor Bill de Blasio at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or you can tweet a question, just use the hashtag, Ask the Mayor. Mr. Mayor, good morning. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian.
First on the breaking news this morning, any reaction to the rape and criminal sexual assault charges filed against Harvey Weinstein this morning, or that the Manhattan DA didn't do this before with the evidence he had?
Look, here's one of the most powerful people in all of Hollywood being held accountable. I think that's a very positive reality in the midst of a very, very sad history here. And this is a triumph for the Me Too movement and everyone who has wanted justice for women, that he is being held accountable and for everyone to see. It's based on something very, very sad, but it indicates something strong and healthy in our democracy, that this movement finally brought people like Harvey Weinstein to justice. So, look, he gets due process like everyone else, but I think it's a powerful moment. I think there's a reason people are focused on it, because it suggests there really is some justice in the world.
Between this taking this long until after the Times articles on Harvey Weinstein were published and the whole Me Too movement broke out and those tapes of his interactions, Weinstein's, with at least one woman at a hotel room door, and the Trump Soho case and some other things in the news regarding arrests in poorer communities of color. Do you have confidence in DA Vance to do the right thing on his own?
Look, I want to separate that in a couple of pieces. The fact that it took so long is not a good thing. I don't know the details and the specifics, but it's not a good thing. I don't think things like this are going to take so long in the future. Again, this is because of a grassroots movement. Let's be really clear. You know, democracy has to be something where the grassroots hold people in power accountable. Change comes from the grassroots. It comes from social movements. So I think what the bottom line is here, you're going to see, and you should see, a lot more speed in following up on things like this in the future. I don't know the specifics of what the DA did. I know the NYPD takes this, and I don't run the DA's office, but I'm in charge of the NYPD as one of my agencies. I know they take this very, very seriously, and anyone who comes forward, their charges will be followed up on very quickly. I also think the other piece of this is, while we see justice being served here, we don't see it being served in the case of the president. We have so many people who have come forward accusing him of sexual harassment, and there's still no investigation going on. I think this is one of the strangest things in the American dialogue right now. Everyone is understandably focused on the Russia probe, but, you know, we have Harvey Weinstein live TV in the courtroom. Everyone's focused on that. How is there no investigation of the president if so many women have come forward and accused him of sexual harassment?
But it sounds like you are saying that it took a grassroots movement to get the DA to do his job.
I'm saying it took a grassroots movement to wake everyone up to the problem here and demand results. I don't know the specifics of what the DA did or didn't. I just don't. But we got to do better going forward. I can say that much.
Next topic. The Furman Center on Housing Policy at NYU, led by one of your former appointees, Vicky Bean, now back in academia, released a major report this week on housing in the city since the year 2000, and it found, among other things, a huge 24% drop in apartments priced for low-income New Yorkers, and that developers are disproportionately building studios and one bedrooms that in effect make housing for families scarcer and more expensive. Are you aware of the new apartment size as a problem, and is there a policy response to that?
Absolutely. This report is helpful, but a lot of what it's showing are things that we've been quite aware of. Let's put this in perspective. We have a city that is growing in population rapidly. We're at 8.6 million, the highest population we've ever had. We're on our way to 9 million as early as 2030. We have a city that more and more people from all over the country, all over the world want to live in. We have the most jobs we've ever had. We're getting close to 4.5 million jobs in this city. These by most normal measures, would be positives. They're creating tremendous pressure in terms of the housing market. And the bottom line here is it's not shocking that in the free enterprise system, the development would follow where the money is. If the money is in the smaller apartments, that's what developers are going to do. I don't like that, but I understand the free enterprise system. Our job is to counter that and balance that in every way we can. So we have an affordable housing plan to build and preserve in place 300,000 apartments. That's enough for almost 750,000 people, so they can live affordably in New York City. But beyond that, we're also greatly reducing the number of affordable apartments that we have lost from regulation. In fact, in 2016 is the last year we have numbers for, about 4,700 apartments went out of regulation. That's the lowest number since 2001. And when you compare that to the beginning of the third Bloomberg term, they lost almost 10,000 more apartments in the year 2009 than we lost last year. That's because there's a lot more toughness here in addressing the loss of affordable apartments. For example, we now provide, and thanks to the good work of the council, we provide free legal support to stop illegal evictions. That's reduced evictions already 27%. We're providing a lot more in the way of direct subsidy to keep people in their apartments and keep them affordable for the long term. A lot of these policies are reducing the loss of affordable housing. We got a lot more to do. And we did rent freezes, and that was another crucial piece. If you have rent freezes or very low rent increases, the apartment doesn't go out of regulation through vacancy decontrol. But the biggest thing here, Brian, is in Albany, next year, there's a chance, particularly there's a Democratic State Senate, to get rid of vacancy decontrol once and for all. This is really the driver of the loss of affordable housing. There's a law that allows affordable housing to no longer be affordable. We got to get rid of that law and protect our rent-regulated housing, which is the core of affordable housing going forward for the future of the city.
The report also found that the median rent for newly built units in 2016 was $400 a month more than for existing units. In the year 2000, the difference in rent was just $50 more a month for new units. Does this make you think twice at all about your approach that the solution to affordability is to build with more density?
I want to clarify that, because a lot of why we support more building and more density is because it also gets us those affordable apartments. And those come with very strict rules about affordability levels. And they are typically affordable for, at minimum, 30 years, in many cases, permanently. So that's part of why I think you do need to keep building. But I think it's also there is a supply and demand reality, and the report points to this. Even though some of the normal supply and demand realities are not happening the way we're used to in this city because of other factors, like the city's gotten a lot safer, there's more jobs, there's a lot of reasons why people want to be here that are pushing up housing costs beyond the question of supply. That said, undoubtedly, if you create more supply, it does put downward pressure on rents. And you've got so many people who want to be here, need to be here, we've got to keep building. So it just makes sense to have a strong government intervention in the market that guarantees affordability. Remember, we also have a law that says when a developer needs a special permit to build, we guarantee affordable housing in the bargain, or they're not allowed to build. That's another very important change in the reality in just the last few years, again, passed by the City Council, something I believed in and pushed for. This makes a huge difference in the equation. So, yeah, we do have to keep building, but with strict rules to guarantee affordability.
And here's a housing question, I think, from Timmy in Chelsea. Timmy, you're on WNYC with the mayor. Hello.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Mr. Mayor.
Good morning.
My question, RE Housing, is will there in fact be an Office of the Tenant Advocate at the Department of Buildings? This was a bill passed by the council, as you had just mentioned, that they were passing stricter laws for housing, and that you signed last August. But on or about April 13th, in a preliminary budget hearing in front of Councilmember Hill and Rosenthal, Commissioner Chandler said, no, the DOB would not fund the Office of the Tenant Advocate. So I'm just trying to follow up here and find out if DOB, in fact, has to comply with the laws of the City of New York or if they can do what they want.
No, they can't just do what they want. Look, I want to say, first of all, anything passed by the council that I sign is going to be implemented, period. Second, I have to tell you, Department of Buildings, when I was running for mayor, is probably the single most criticized department in the city for a wide variety of reasons. I want to give Commissioner Chandler credit. I think he's made a lot of big changes there, but we got to do more. Department of Buildings, originally, in my view, was not tenant-friendly, was not focused on preserving affordable housing, didn't see it as part of their mission, didn't have enough resources either. We've added hundreds of more inspectors, and we've made very clear to Department of Buildings that they are also a very important part of the effort to preserve affordable housing and to stop landlord harassment. And I think the Department of Buildings more and more is doing that. The council also passed some new additional anti-harassment laws that help a lot that I very much supported.
Anything
that we've committed to will be built.
What's the tenant advocate? What's the office of, I'm asking
you? The notion
you.
Of anything like that is to make sure that the interests of tenants are also focused on by an agency. And again, in context also of new anti-harassment laws that were passed last year, and Department of Buildings plays a crucial role in addressing landlord harassment of tenants. So we will make sure that the apparatus we need is in place to protect tenants.
Tashi in Queens. You're on WNYC with the mayor. Hello, Tashi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. Good morning.
What's your question for the mayor?
Oh, good morning, everyone. Good morning, Ms. Mayor.
Good morning.
How are you? My question is it's very specific. It's also related to immigrant, I guess. So my dad, we are originally from Tibet. So when I just came here, he started selling pictures and photos on the street to support our family. And then he eventually got his smoothie car. He's still working in Forest Hill right now. But the thing is, he was never able to get his permit. I think Mayor is familiar with the issue because I have been watching the town hall before. Actually, my dad went to the one in Forest Hill, I guess.
So your dad, if I can cut in to help you for time, your dad has been on a waiting list for a permit to sell smoothies for 15 years, and he paid $20,000 to rent a permit from a current owner. You want to tell that story just a little bit, Tashi?
Yeah, that's pretty much the story. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah, because I feel really bad for my dad, because we started talking about for him to get retired because there's no way for him to secure a permit. Last year, we thought we might be able to get one.
This would be for a street vendor's permit, Tashi?
Yes. I think for food vendor, yeah.
Uh-huh. So
I'm not exactly clear about the system, but I'm sure that for my dad to have his own business, he needs to have a permit.
Do you think, Tashi, that your father's experience is that the system is at least honest and there's just a 15-year waiting list? Or is it worse than that?
He is on a waiting list, I remembered. But there is nothing happened.
For 15 years?
Yeah.
Mr.
In, I guess the 2000.
Yeah.
Around 2000.
Yeah, so that would be almost 20 years. Mr. Mayor, does it take that long to get a food vendor permit?
First of all, Brian, I can't answer the question factually because I just am not an expert on the wait list for food vendor permits, but I know there are limits on the number of legal vendors in the city. This is a big issue. It's come up at a lot of my town hall meetings. People have strong views on all sides of this issue. We got close to some new rules and regulations at the end of last year. Didn't work out with the city council. We're going to be looking to act on that again. But on this specific question, Tashi, I'm sorry that your dad has gone through this because obviously he's trying to make a living. We want to support in every way we can. There is a limit. There's a real limit on the number of vendors. So I just don't know where he is on that list and what the specifics are. Tashi, if you will provide your information to WNYC, I'll have my folks follow up with you and see if there's anything that we can do to help your dad out.
Tashi, hang on. We'll get your contact information. I want to ask you, Mr. Mayor, about the 4,200 pages of emails you released yesterday between you and the political consulting firm Berlin Rosen, with which you were very close, especially their principal, Jonathan Rosen. By way of background for our listeners, New York One and the New York Post went to court and won release of these emails after you had claimed that the emails should be kept confidential as if between you and city officials because the consultants were, in effect, agents of the city. Now, much of the coverage of the email so far has been about attitudes toward the news media that you express. We know that you've publicly called the New York Post a right-wing rag and at least once refused to answer questions from a Post reporter because you didn't like a previous story. But I want to ask about the mainstream, not right-wing media. After you didn't like a profile in The Atlantic, you wrote, "I strongly advise we avoid profiles from now on, especially from national publications. I have no use for these people. Let's just do the work and go right around the so-called referees," unquote. And on the New York Times, after criticizing a specific Times story as biased, you wrote in a general way, "What did I say about how disappointing the Times has become? And we need to figure out a new paradigm with the Times. This level of bias can't be ignored. Either starve them or reason with them or something else," unquote. So my first question is, do you think not just the Post and Daily News, but the New York Times is biased against you in a general way?
I think there's a problem with mainstream media. I mean, I'll get to the specific, but I think the broad point is there's a problem with mainstream media. I have felt this my whole life. This is not new to my role as mayor. We have a corporate media. It is based on a free enterprise model. It's based on selling things. I don't think that's healthy. I think that leads to a lot of distortions. I am a big fan of public radio and public TV. I'm a big fan of alternative media and subscription-based media like The Guardian that are trying to take some of the bias out of the equation that is based, that comes from needing clicks and having a mentality that connects to a corporate structure. So, I felt this my whole life. The bottom line is I think we need and deserve much better. And when I wrote those things, I mean, look, the whole underlying reality here is the legal guidance I had received from the City Hall staff was that those particular interactions with trusted advisors were something we could do frankly and would not be publicly disclosable and did not have to be publicly disclosable. Obviously, that was a mistake, and if we had known that, we wouldn't have put those things into email. The kind of conversations that bluntly everyone has all the time in public life. But I don't think the coverage has reflected the work we're doing or the impact it's having on the people of the city. And, Brian, you and I have talked about this on air. Mm-hmm. I think there's a disconnect. I think, we have 8.6 million people who really, really care about what affects their lives, their schools, jobs, quality of life in their community. But a lot of the coverage is always personalities and sensationalization and, I think, distortion of a lot of what's really happening. And I'm comfortable saying I don't think that's the best we can be, and I'm not going to simply accept that.
But you lump the Times and the Atlantic in with the tabloids in those characteristics?
No, each one's different. I think the tabloid culture, and I've said it very publicly, I think has been harmful to New York City. It sensationalizes and often divides us, and it has for a long, long time, and the Post is the leading edge of that. But, no, I have a critique of the Times, too. I don't think, I've said this publicly also, I don't think they focus enough on the city they're based in. I'd like to see more coverage that talks about the grassroots. I think there's obviously an elite orientation at the Times. That's not a news flash. It's not my cup of tea. That's a problem. But, I think in general, the worldview is not from the grassroots up. And that's part of my critique. Just when we started this broadcast or this interview, change comes from the grassroots. I'd like to see a whole lot more coverage focus on the grassroots. I'd like to see a lot more coverage of the things we're doing and what it means for everyday people. And I'm always, I hate to say always, often disappointed that we don't see that.
The Daily News today compares you to Trump in your general disdain for the press, such as when you wrote in one of the emails, "The news media is pitiful and it's sad for our city and nation," unquote. So do you think that you and Donald Trump are being subjected to similar forces of sensationalism in the media?
That's a ridiculous simplification, and I think it kind of is the case in point. Donald Trump and I are about the most polar opposite people in the world. He's a billionaire who is trying to increase the power of the wealthy and is in so many ways a negative, divisive figure. He has been for decades. And his approach is a systematic effort to undermine our institutions. He's trying to undermine the free press. He's trying to undermine our law enforcement institutions. He's trying to undermine democracy. It's quite plain. I have a critique of the corporate media, and I have a critique of the tabloid culture. They're entirely different realities. Donald Trump was created by the tabloid culture. I mean, let's be real about this. And there's been some great reporting, by the way. I want to give credit where credit is due. A great piece in New York Magazine, for example, by Mark Harris a few months back, that got to the essence of how Donald Trump was a creature and a creation of the tabloid culture. No, there's no comparison whatsoever here, and I just find it amazing that that's the best that people can come up with.
In one email, you're speculating about market forces in the newspaper industry, and you wonder if the Post might go out of business, and you call that wishful thinking. Maybe that was just a joke, but would you really like to see the main opposition paper in the city go under?
I'll tell you what I feel. I believe the Post is not only right-wing, not only distorts the facts on a regular basis, but is divisive, and I'm shocked. I'm shocked that more people don't come out and say it, because it used to be a commonplace thing to talk about not so many years ago in New York City. And just look at the headlines every day and look at the dog whistling that goes on in the New York Post all the time. Come on. No, I will not shed a tear if that newspaper is no longer here, because I think we need a better civic discourse. There's more and more media than ever. This is a really good thing. There's more alternative media. There's more outlets than we've ever had, or we have had in a long, long time, because of social media. There's plenty of tough reporting, plenty of insightful reporting, plenty of questioning of authority. But come on, the Post is not like everyone else, and I think we should just stop the charade. Their presence in our society, unfortunately, is harmful.
And finally on this, on your relationship with Berlin Rosen, you wanted these emails to be kept secret from the public because you said they were acting as agents of the city. But the emails include discussions about a real estate project, for example, and the Coalition for the Homeless, for another example, that were clients of Berlin Rosen's that wanted things from the city. So do you regret claiming that a consulting company with whom you were discussing their clients' interests, do you regret claiming to New Yorkers that that consulting firm was an agent of the people?
I think there's a couple different pieces here. I regret the whole thing, because we duly receive from the City Hall staff, from the legal staff, et cetera, guidance on how to address this issue. Close advisors, like everyone has, every leader in history has a group of close advisors. They don't all work in government. So the question became, in a world where email was more central to our lives than ever before, more central than, you know, 10 or even 15 years ago even, how do you handle that? And the guidance was, you can have frank discussions, and they are protected because they're part of doing the work of government. So that's part one of this. That guidance was wrong. It turned out to be wrong. And I regret following guidance that turned out to be wrong. I'm not a lawyer. I did not realize it was wrong, or we wouldn't have done it. We won't do it anymore. I made that clear a long time ago. We do not have those conversations on email. We've changed a lot of the things we do. But on the question of where any firm has lobbying interests or business interests, so point one, I don't talk to city registered lobbyists who lobby for third party interests. I don't talk to them anymore about their business dealings than their clients. I just don't. I've made an across the board policy that I don't do that. Second, anything like that, my understanding of the law, that was disclosable anyway. Separate, for example, if one of these individuals gave advice on an issue, that's a very different reality than they said, hey, my client is Coalition for Homeless, and I think you should do X about homelessness. Anything that is client-based was disclosable anyway. So, and I think that's an important separation to make. But look, this was a mistake. It was not an ill-intentioned mistake, but it was a mistake. It won't happen again, to say the least. And we're just going to move forward.
Sandra in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with the mayor. Hello, Sandra.
Hi. Good morning, Brian. I listened to you for years. Mr. Mayor, I need your help on an important thing. I manage and I co-lead four Girl Scout troops in East Harlem. One of my girls lives in a shelter. She goes to school in East Harlem. Her family moved into a shelter in the Bronx. at this shelter, the first one, they just didn't even answer when I asked if she could stay overnight at our a program, a scout night at the Intrepid. Okay. So now we're up to having all of our girls go to Camp Kaufman in Dutchess County. That's the Girl Scout camp there. The mother was put into another shelter. She said to the social worker upon arrival, I'm going to get you all the permission forms, and I hope you will approve that her daughter can go to Camp Kaufman. So I prepared everything, sent it in. The mother gave it to the social worker. She came back. She said she has to take it up through the administration. And they came back and they said to her, we don't approve things like that. And, of course, the child is heartbroken. She's the only child who's not going on the trip. And I just think, you know, this is our New York City shelter system. We should be able to do better for children.
You're right about that. Well, first of all, thank you for what you're doing. I really admire it and appreciate it. There's a couple different quick pieces. First of all, there's extraordinary work being done with the Girl Scouts in our shelter system. And, you know, the fact that we have so many people in shelter is so painful and something we're trying to change over time. But in the meantime, the Girl Scouts have been a really positive, helpful force in the shelter system, and I'd like to see a lot more of that. Second, you know, we're trying to rationalize when someone's in shelter to create a more rational system for where they are geographically that keeps them closer to their home community and closer to their child's school. That's a big change we're making, and hopefully that will help in its own right. On this question, when is the trip in question to the camp?
It's the second weekend in June.
Okay. I have a lot of confidence.
So it's coming up upon us right now.
Yes, absolutely. I have a lot of confidence we can fix this. I'm really sorry you had to go through it, and I also am really glad you're calling it in because this will now alert everyone at Homeless Services that we don't want to see this kind of thing happen to any other child or any other parent. That chance to go to summer camp is obviously a fantastic opportunity and a welcome break from what so many of these kids are having to deal with. So we want to make it work. Give your information to WNYC so we can fix the situation with this child and get it resolved so she can go to camp. But I also am going to ask the folks at Department of Homeless Services to right away make sure that all personnel and shelters know that these kind of requests need to be expedited and that we want to support these opportunities for these kids. So I'm really happy you called us in.
Sandra, hang on. We'll get that contact info from you. Here's a question via Twitter from listener Madeline in the Rockaways. The question is about Rockaway Beach. And I think, if I saw your schedule correctly, you're going out to Coney Island this morning to kick off the beach season.
Yep.
So from Rockaway Beach, Madeline asks, how come such a huge section of Rockaway Beach is closed this summer? New York Times reports the city knew it was eroding but decided not to act because it's at highest level in many years. What gives? Asks Madeline.
Yeah, this is a very tough situation and not one that I feel happy about, to say the least. We all knew the beach was eroding, and I was at a town hall meeting in the Rockaways, I think it was about 6 months ago, and this topic came up. I pledged to folks in the community that I would go to the Army Corps of Engineers. That's really where the opportunity to fix things is. The only way we can truly fix long-term, you know, viable fix for the situation of the beach is to get the Army Corps of Engineers in. They bring the expertise, they bring the resources. I got an agreement from the head of the Army Corps to give us a firm answer. I went down to Washington and met with him to get a firm answer by this summer of the timeline for doing this work. But the erosion, which was bad 6 months ago, got a lot worse in the last couple of months because of some specific storms. And then the question became, the Parks Department talked to the lifeguards, who really have to be the final word here, and said, can we secure this area properly, as this beach has gotten a lot thinner than it even was a year ago, and they did not feel we could. So the decision was late because the situation changed, and because we were trying to find any other alternative we thought could work. But Parks Department felt strongly, as a question of safety, we just couldn't secure that stretch of beach the way we need to. Everything else will be open, so about 4.5 miles of beach are open in the Rockaways. The various concessions will still be open. People are still going to have a lot of ability to enjoy the Rockaways. But it's just a situation that it was bad 6 months ago. It got worse in the last few months, and we had to make a safety-based decision.
Here's one that's also in its way related to the beaches. City Council is considering a ban on plastic straws and coffee stirrers in restaurants because of the pollution they cause, including washing up on the beach. Would you sign such a bill?
I believe in that idea. I believe plastic straws are really harmful to the environment. They're really harmful to our oceans and marine life. They're kind of a classic American thing that, you know, we didn't have them for generations. We all were fine, and then we got used to them, but we don't really need them. I have not seen the specific legislation, so I have to see if we, you know, my team and I agree with the specifics of the bill. But the intent, absolutely. I hope at some point soon to be signing a piece of legislation that bans plastic straws in New York City. And by the way, I grew up with paper straws. They were fine. I guarantee people that there's going to be good alternatives that will still work for them.
And last thing, it was a year ago this week that you announced a crackdown on parking placard corruption. But every day on Twitter, our newsroom tells me they're seeing images of cars with city placards parking in playgrounds, on sidewalks, forcing pedestrians to walk in the street. It appears to some people that the crackdown may not have buy-in from the NYPD or fire department or Department of Education, where a lot of this problem seems to crop up around schools. Any one-year update or are further steps needed?
Well, let me say a couple things. There will be an update very soon. This is a real important issue. I want to make sure the people of this city see that real change is happening on placard abuse. I don't accept it. It really drives me crazy, just like every other New Yorker who sees this kind of stuff. It's not right. We're not going to stand for it. We're going to show people soon what we have achieved in the first year, but there's a lot more to come. So the bottom line is I do believe there's examples of abuse that we still haven't gotten to and we need to. You said it seems, and I really want to emphasize that, what it seems versus what it is are often two different things. We need to show people the facts. But, Brian, I am intolerant of this abuse. We're going to go after it hard, and we're going to throw a lot of resources in. We have in year one. We're going to keep building that enforcement in year two. And anyone who abuses a placard is going to find out there are real negative consequences for that.
What should the NYPD do if anybody with a placard is parked in a playground?
I think the bottom line is if anybody is violating placard rules, there have to be very clear, strict consequences than there are. I mean, there's all sorts of fines and penalties and other efforts that can be put in place to show people that if you do something like that, if you park in front of a hydrant, you park in front of a driveway, you park in front of or on a playground, that you're really going to have some serious consequences and that they will escalate. And for public employees, too. That not only are there going to be fines, but there's internal discipline that will be applied if a public employee violates the rules of their placard or has an illegal placard or a made-up placard. We're not going to tolerate this stuff.
I'm going to practice saying placard parking in a playground 10 times fast before the next time I ask you that question. Mr. Mayor, thank you very much for joining us. Talk to you next week.
And a very happy Memorial Day to everyone.